The Fan on Demand.
You're about to get an earful and a brainful. This is Primetime Sports with Bob McCowan on the Sportsnet Radio Network. This is
Tuesday, April the 8th, 2014, Primetime Sports on your radio, on your television. It's Canada's most listened to sports talk show. It's Bob McCown, Stephen Brent in our Toronto studios. A little later on, Dave Smart will join us. He's a men's basketball coach at Carleton. Why would he come on at this point? Well, pretty good basketball program.
National champions.
And they also beat the Wisconsin Badgers in a preseason game this year. And I'm not sure what that means. Meant for the Wisconsin Badgers or for the Carleton program necessarily. We'll find out what the coach thinks about it. Dave Smart will join us in a bit. The story today that we are addressing is, of course, the firing of Mike Gillis by the Vancouver Canucks with, you know, a week to go in the regular season. Why did it happen? Is there a replacement? Is there one guy comes in and takes the mantle of general manager and president of hockey ops? Is it two guys? Does Tortorella survive? And there's differing opinions on this. Some believe that Tortorella would have been fired instead of Gillis, that they made a choice. And others ascribe to the philosophy, and I think this is Brent and I, have a slightly different opinion on this. I happen to think that if you're gonna fire somebody, you fire the general manager first, and then allow the incoming general manager to have some input on the coach.
Yeah,
whether that happens or not, I don't know.
I don't think the coach is going anywhere. So we differ.
Well, I know, yeah. And I'm not saying he is going anywhere. What I'm saying is, I don't preclude the possibility of hiring the general manager and allowing him to make a decision on the coach. After all, you're doing it at a time where it gives you the maximum amount of time.
That would be the sensible thing to do. I just don't think the sensible thing is going to be done.
And quite often in sport, it is not. Ed Willis with the Vancouver Province joins to talk about this. How surprised were you by the announcement today? I mean, probably not hugely, but a little bit?
The timing. What was the surprising factor? I don't think anybody would be surprised at what happened. By the same token, I don't think anybody could have safely predicted this was going to be the first course of action, especially with three games to go in the regular season. And just as an aside, the timing of this is really interesting because the deadline for Canucks season ticket renewals is tomorrow. Mm-hmm. And I think almost everything in this drama has to be viewed against the backdrop of the damage which has been done to the Canucks brand this season. There was a time when Canucks tickets were gold in this market, and over the last half of the season, you've just seen that deteriorate, and we've seen that lower bowl, a third full. It might have been a half full last night, and it was just like one of those soul-sucking scenes where you just said, this is so wrong and this is so bad, and they're going to have a hell of a job getting this one back on the rails.
What do you mean? What do you think the timing of this announcement signifies?
I think it's saying, look, you know, we understand we've got a big problem here, and we're going to make big steps to correct it. And I do believe Trevor Linden is going to be the first hire, the first domino to fall, and that will be a popular choice with the masses. It will placate. It will go a while. It will go a ways to restoring the credibility of this franchise. But in and by itself, it's not the only thing that needs to be done.
We'll talk about Linden. I don't want to. Just to go back for a second, Ed, do you think the Gillis radio interview the last straw? Do you think that kind of forced their hand?
That's the way it's kind of being interpreted, Steve. It's almost like you have to be a Kremlinologist here. You know, you study the figures on the May Day viewing stand and who's in favor and who's not in favor and who's standing closest to to Brezhnev or whoever it was. It's crazy, but that, I mean, the consensus seemed to be he was sending the message, and I thought he was talking over Francesco's head to Luigi Aquilini, the patriarch of the family. I think he sensed Francesco was dragging his heels on the Tortorella decision, and Mike wanted, you know, a clear mandate from ownership that things are going to be done his way, and I think we got our answer today about the way ownership feels about that.
It did seem like it's him or me. You know, that's...
Yeah. Like I said, that's certainly the interpretation.
Yeah. Okay.
That's going down here.
So Lyndon comes in presumably as president. And as you say, he's kind of Mr. Canuck in a lot of ways, so that will be very popular. But what is that job going to be under Trevor? What would Trevor Lyndon do in that job?
Well, you know, this is the thing. He's been, you know, taking part in triathlons and, you know, building these fitness facilities. He's, you know, he's been involved in the game. But, you know, a normal organization, they take their face of the franchise, the popular guy, they make him the player director of player development for a couple of years, then make him the AGM for a couple of years, and they slide him into the big office. Of course, Trevor and Gillis ended up on the wrong side of the 2004-2005 lockout, so they were at loggerheads. Trevor's been estranged from the organization. Now they're bringing him back. Like I said, it'll be a popular decision, but he's still got to deliver the goods, and nobody knows what, you know, is he going to get to hire the GM? Is he going to get to hire the coach? These are all things that will will out over time. I think they're buying themselves a bit of time here, and I agreed with your assessment there that, we've got our CEO. Now we're going to give him a chance to examine the organization and buy some time moving forward. I'm still, but if I can just get back to this idea of the damage to the brand, I'm not sure they can bring Tortorella back based on what I've seen this season and the way Canucks fans have universally rejected the style of play that the Canucks have been employing.
I don't want to suggest that Trevor Lyndon isn't qualified for this job, but from afar, his appointment seems rather obvious and at the same time and predictable. At the same time, it might be the most common mistake made in sport. Let's bring back one of our icons, one of our heroes. Cite the case of how many times that really works. Do you subscribe to that theory or not?
No. I think, I think there's a way to do it. And I look at what the Red Wings did with Steve Yzerman and countless other organizations.
But that's not what's happening here.
No, it isn't. And that's what I'm saying. That's what I'm, you know, a normal organization that, you know, they groom the guy.
Right.
They give him a 4 or 5 year apprenticeship to learn the ropes and to, you know, and make his bones. They haven't done that here. So it kind of smacks a bit of desperation. And this ownership group and this organization has used up all their goodwill with the franchise. So, you know, if this doesn't take right away, they've got massive, massive problems. Trevor buys them a bit of goodwill right off the hop. But, I mean, if what we've seen this season is a continuation next season, it's going to get ugly.
And again, I mean, what I'm hearing from you is that there is a real crisis here in the relationship with the fan base and the ability even to sell tickets going down the road. And that's what that's the bridge that Lyndon creates, because it's not going to be, when push comes to shove and they drop the puck again in October, it's going to be about results.
Yeah.
And, you know, is Trevor Lyndon the guy to execute and produce those results? And if you believe that, based on what?
Well, you know, yeah, that's it. It's a gamble. It's a huge gamble, you know, like for the popularity factor. Yeah, we'll give them that. We'll give them, it'll buy some time. We'll quell the masses, give them a certain comfort level going forward. Trevor is, you know, universally admired in this market. But again, I keep coming back to the tire fire that is this season, and that face in and by itself doesn't correct everything that's happened in this market, and it doesn't assuage the fan base completely. And they've got a big job to do. Trevor might be the right guy. I don't know. I do agree with your assessment. And this is a great analogy. I think, Steve, you'll appreciate that. Somebody compared it to the Lions bringing Joe Catt back in
2009. Oh, yeah. I think Trevor's considerably more sane than Joe Catt, but I get it.
He's got that going for him. He's not certifiable. He's got that going for him. But like I said, this is, you know, and from a media guy's point of view, this is another gift that keeps on giving. We thought, you know, goalie confidential was good, but this one's been even better.
I'm interested in talking about Tortorella. Maybe is too toxic, maybe just too toxic to bring back. But you know, there's obviously complicating factors here, right? It would appear that he is the Aquilini's guy. They owe him a lot of money, and there's a lot of term left. You know, one of the things that's been kicked around here was the notion that could you sell, Trevor Linden, Jay Feaster, John Tortorella, and say, well, Feaster and Tortorella have worked together. They won a Stanley Cup together. This is going to work.
That's certainly one of the scenarios that's, you know, that's out there right now. Again, hate to sound like a broken record, based on what hockey fans saw this season, from the style of play Tortorella was preaching, and you know, when it was successful, it was okay. It wasn't great to watch, but you know, when it was successful, it was okay. But from the New Year's on, they've basically been an expansion team. You know, they haven't scored. They can't defend. They've got these good young players. I've got a couple of good young players in Nicholas Jansen and Zach Kassian, who just aren't getting any ice time and don't seem to be developing. So you bring back Tortorella, there's that black cloud from this season hanging over him. And I, you know, with all due respect to Jay Feaster, who is he to Vancouver fans? He's a guy who worked with Tortorella, who had his best years a decade ago in Tampa. I don't know if that washes, but believe me, Steve, everything is in play with this. So everything and anything is in play with this ownership group.
So Francesco Aquilini is going to have a press conference on, I think
tomorrow.
He's going to do the talking tomorrow, right?
Well, yeah, unless he brings Trevor out, and I think Francesco isn't great in front of the media, and you know, we were speculating today. I'm not sure if he goes out and tries to send the right message. Now, if he shows up with Trevor, and Trevor presents well, Trevor looks great in a suit, Trevor will give good media. I think Trevor will bring the temperature down a bit here. That's what I would see happening. That's what I think a rational organization would do. We'll see what happens tomorrow.
Yeah, because I was thinking about exactly that. You know, Francesco Aquilini, in the times that I've, you know, I don't know him, but I've, you know, the rare times I've seen him, you know, in those kind of situations, that's not his forte. You know, he's not a front man.
No, he isn't. And again, you know, if Trevor is the guy and all indications seem to be, you know, why would you wait? Why would you wait making that announcement?
You've only had a few hours to kind of noodle this, although maybe you've had a few weeks to kind of noodle this because it seemed inevitable that something was going to happen. Who's the best case scenario as GM? Who's the best case scenario if Tortorella goes and they have to bring in a coach?
Wow. Yeah. Again, four, five, six different scenarios. And you know, I almost plug it, you know, like it's almost like a casting call. So do you bring in the veteran guy? Do you bring in a guy like Feaster because of his connection? Or do you maybe go a little outside the box and bring in, you know, one of the young guns, one of the rising stars in the professional? They've got a guy here named Lawrence Gilman who's been the AGM, who's done really a terrific job of negotiating contracts and managing the payroll. Not a sexy name, not a lot of clout there, but you know, I think they could sell him. There's Julian Brisebois in Montreal. There's Jason Botterill in Pittsburgh. I think Paul Fenton deserves a look. That's the other scenario. I'm not sure if they would have the patience. If the fan base would have the patience to watch a young kid come in and, you know, learn his craft and learn on the job. That's it. I keep looking at Bob Nicholson and thinking there's a place for him here. He's a BC guy. He interviewed for the president's job, I'm trying to try back about 8-10 years ago. Not even that long ago. It was about 7-8 years ago, about the time they hired Gillis as the GM. So got a bit of a connection. And again, you know, a name that's very familiar that hockey fans would be comfortable with.
Although he seems more of a fit for the job that Trevor Linden's about to take.
Absolutely. 100%. Absolutely, Steve. Yeah. Absolutely. Couldn't agree more. And the other name you hear floating around is Marcus Naslund. You know, one of our
guys. That's interesting.
Yeah, one of our guys at the province got a hold of him, and, you know, guy who has a pretty good relationship with him, and Marcus clammed right up on him. I'm not talking. I'm not commenting on anything. So Trevor is the president. Marcus is the GM. They've got, they've got Gilman and Lauren Henning, who are two pretty good veteran hockey guys surrounding him. Again, that's possible. It's one of the 15 possibilities that are in play now.
And whoever it is. Is, you know, when you look at this team and you've watched, you know, as you watch this team this year, and you just say there's been high drama after high drama. But the bottom line is you have to, somebody is going to take a team where the core is the Twins, and a bit more than that, but the core is the Twins, and that's going to be the task. Can you build a good team, a winning team, a championship contending team around the Twins at this stage?
But probably not. But can you be competitive? Can you be, can you have a respectable finish? Can you play an entertaining style? Twins turn 34 next fall. You know, so Tamu Solani played his last year 44. I realize the guy's a freak.
Yeah.
But 34, you know, isn't over the hill as far as a hockey team goes. They've got some nice young pieces coming. They've still, like this season has just been such a train wreck. When you look at, you know, the established level of productions of Canucks players over their careers versus this year, it's just astonishing. It's right across the board. Like, Alex Burrows was a proven 25 to 30 goal scorer. He's got 5 frickin' goals this year. Alex Edler is minus 33. He looked like an all-star defenseman 3 years ago. I mean, the Twins have both won Art Ross trophies. I don't think they're going to get to 50 points this season. It's just been crazy what happened. So, you know, if you think, and granted, it isn't the greatest philosophy that things can't possibly be as bad as they were this year, but I think that's part of the thinking going forward, that things can't possibly be as bad again as they were this year.
Yeah, but you're talking offensive stats and a coach who preaches a system that doesn't encourage offense.
Another reason why I don't think Tortorella will be back.
Well, that's exactly where I think all conversations wind up leading you to, whether you believe in the guy or don't believe in the guy. The way he coached this year and the way he has coached in the past, clearly it was oil and water when it came to this group of Canucks players. Can't change all the players, yeah. Although you changed all the goaltenders, so I guess anything's possible. But so either this coach has an epiphany or is ordered to coach differently, or he's on the next bus out of Vancouver. Let me throw a stupid name at you and to get your take on it. And this is a real stretch. But if you know, here in Toronto, there's lots of talk about whether Nonis and Carlisle survive the Maple Leafs' latest debacle. If Nonis were available, how does that fit in Vancouver?
My short answer is that would be not in a million years. If you know the relationship between Nonis and Francesco,
okay,
it ended in a bad way,
gotcha.
And the hiring of Gillis was not great. And I wouldn't say no to anything at this stage, but that would be as close as I would get to saying unequivocally no.
Well. It wasn't the most unexpected announcement I've ever heard, but then again, the timing was a little surprising, and it did catch a lot of us a bit off guard here.
I guess if we'd known about that ticket renewal deadline, we wouldn't be so surprised.
I'm just wondering how that plays into this.
Well, it sounds like optics were taken into account.
Yeah, you know, like I said, in and by itself, but if you think of that as being, you know, symbolic of the damage that's been done to the of what's going on in the business off the ice, you know, then I think the timing of this announcement starts to make a little more sense. Yeah,
it just seems to me that the smart, astute business decision, if you're worried about season ticket holders. And what did you say? When's the deadline? Tomorrow?
I believe it's tomorrow. Yeah,
I'd have made this move a week ago. I mean, right now, what you have is no GM, no president, and a coach that probably is on his way out. I don't know how that inspires you to buy tickets. I think you got to go. You got to go the whole route. You got to say, here's what I'm doing. Now maybe that happens tomorrow morning, and they're hoping for 6 hours of flooding the phone lines. But I don't know, Mike Keenan. I don't know what who can you go get? Who do you go get?
Well, you know, and this is the other thing. So, you know, like, so they hire a GM, and now, and here's your coach, John Tortorella. Like, who in their right mind takes that job under those circumstances, unless it's somebody so desperate for a job?
I know.
You brought back Keenan, and the joke I was making is, you know, maybe it's a step forward. You know, the last time they went down this road, it was a player who named the GM or Messier. At least this time, maybe it's going to be the owner who names the GM.
Yikes.
It's crazy, and I don't see it ending nice and neatly and all tied up with the ribbon on it anytime soon.
Ed, good of you to take time for us on what's obviously a hysterically busy day for you. We greatly appreciate it. Thanks, pal.
Okay, guys.
Thanks,
all
Ed.
The best.
Ed Willis of the Vancouver Province.
What a gong show, eh? Makes things look pretty straightforward here on the hockey front.
Nah. Yeah, I mean, it's intriguing, though. The timing is the one. And maybe it's just, I don't think it has anything to do with season tickets. I think it's a function of the timing of the radio interview.
Yeah, I think Gillis forced their hand.
It took them a few days to figure out exactly what they wanted to do.
Well, and you also decide, you know, can we ride this out? And at a certain point you go,
no,
I don't think we can ride this out. The natives are restless. We got to do something. You're out. But, it's too bad they couldn't get rid of that schmuck that hired Tortorella. But he owns the team, right? So you can't.
Well, says you. I don't know anything about that. I don't know who hired him.
You know, you're talking about what a disaster, what a terrible fit. It's obvious it was a terrible fit. Wait, who did that? Who is that guy?
I don't know.
Well,
might have been you for all I know.
It could have been.
He's the head coach of the national championship basketball team in this country. His team, the Carleton Ravens, played a preseason game against the Wisconsin Badgers and beat Wisconsin. Now, I wasn't there. I don't know who played and how serious everything was, but you not only beat a Division I school, you beat a school that turned out to be one of the best in U.S. college basketball. Dave Smart is the head coach at Carleton and joins us on the line. Hi, Coach. How you doing?
Good. How are you guys doing?
Good. A belated congratulations on a national championship. Tell me a little bit about that Badgers game as a preseason game. It's not unusual for your team to play preseason games against big-time U.S. college opposition. How did that game unfold?
Well, I was with the national team in Puerto Rico, so my assistant was actually at. He did the game. We were part of the preparation, and I was part of the pre and post watching it. They're of all the really good Division I teams in the U.S., like the top 25 teams or the top 20 teams in the U.S., they're probably the best matchup for us. I mean, just because of the way they play and they're not quite as athletic as some of the other top 20 teams. So it worked out well. We played FIBA rules, and that was an advantage. I mean, both teams played eight guys. I mean, they only played the eight guys or seven or eight guys that they played that you saw in the final four game and throughout the tournament. It wasn't like either team played everybody. Both teams played their best guys. But the FIBA rules helped. You know, playing them by our rules certainly helped. And again, athletically, we match up. They're a little bigger in the front court, but in the back court, they're not bigger than us. So, and our back court really matches up with most teams.
I was going to say, but Dave, you know, when people, you know, that result obviously jumped out at people this year. And, as with CIS football, there's always that. One of the things people do is say, well, where does this stack up against? You know, now in football, it's a different game, different rules. But, you know, your program is the gold standard of CIS basketball. When you look at the universe of NCAA basketball, and obviously this is the time of year when people pay more attention than any other, where is your team in that continuum of, you know, we've seen a national championship decided in the United States. We understand, you know, the different layers and different levels. Where would your team be?
I think it's hard to say. I mean, it's The pro CIS people sort of talk like, well, they beat Wisconsin by 13, the anti CIS, the pro NCAA say, well, you know, they don't beat teams down there. Well, we went down and we lost by 3 to Cincinnati, who were ranked as high as I think 6 or 7 in the country, and we lost by 3 at their place. And again, it's a November game, but both teams played 8-9 guys, a few years ago or 2 years ago, when St. Louis went to the Final 32, they won a game they might have gone to the Sweet 16, but they definitely won their first game. They came up and we played them twice and beat them by 25 and beat them by 12 and back-to-back games where they played their best guys, we played our best guys. It's so hard to say in March. You know, I think if they played the same schedule as we played, or we played the same schedule as they played, I think by March, I think both teams would be in a similar spot. I think there's a huge advantage for them when we play them on the road, and I think there's a huge advantage for us when they play us on the road. I think both groups take it a little differently, you know, based on where we play them. When we play them there, we're playing to prepare for our next league game, which is 5 days away. So we're trying to win, but we're preparing in a different way. When they play us up here, both teams are preparing for, you know, trying to figure out where people fit. And in fairness to them, they have a shorter lifespan on guys in their program, so mm-hmm. there's probably more role definement issues. They still practice probably more than we do for that game because they get 10 days, they go twice a day. We practice probably less than they do for that game, but their role definition situation is a lot different in August. Our roles are more established only because we have our guys for a longer time, like more years of eligibility.
Right. What does this mean, Coach, for you in terms of recruiting, in terms of getting kids to come and play for in your program?
Well, I mean, I think it helps. I think you'd be surprised how little of an effect the D1 dream is incredible, I say this from a CIS perspective, but I say it also from a coaching perspective in terms of like jobs, whether it's down there or here. The NCAA Division I basketball isn't all Division I basketball. Syracuse isn't the same as the teams that are ranked out of the top 100. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's 350 schools, and there's a ton of levels of Division I basketball. The problem is, I think it's great for the kids, the Andrew Wiggins of the world, the Tyler Ennis's of the world, the Olivia Hanlons, who are going to ACC-type schools, top 50 schools.
Right.
But for these kids who are going to 150 to 350, there are at least 10 CIS schools who are way better decisions for them in terms of development, in terms of their life after basketball, but their life in basketball after their university career. They're just better decisions. But unfortunately, most of the coaches and most of the players see Division I as Division I, and it's just not the same. I mean, Tyler Ennis should have gone to Syracuse. Olivia Hanlon should have gone to Boston College. They shouldn't be playing the CIS. But the guys who are going to the schools that are 150 and above, who are passing up opportunities to stay in Canada, you know, both academically and basketball-wise, but, I mean, we're just talking basketball. Basketball, it's a bad decision. It's just a bad decision. And unfortunately, that's where the problems lie. It's not with the kids who are going to the big name schools.
I mean, how do you change that, Coach? I mean, you know, do you have to get? Does there have to be a CIS player drafted?
Maybe. I mean, or CIS player make it. I mean, I think whether they make it or get drafted to make it, they've got to make it. So even if they got drafted in the second round and didn't make it, it wouldn't have the same impact as going as a free agent and making it. And know, the key is being ready when you go. I mean, it's like Olivier Hanlon, the kid who came up through our club, my club system, and he's at a stage where for 2 years, some people are telling him he should go to the draft, and if you're not a first round draft pick. I mean, none of these guys are really ready for the NBA.
No.
Very few. I mean, in the last 2 years, how many first-round draft picks are really ready for the NBA? But by being a first-round draft pick, they get 3 years guaranteed, and those NBA teams are investing in them for those 3 years. So it makes total sense if you're going to be a first-round draft pick to go, because you can develop in the NBA. You're making a pile of money. But if you're going to be a second-round draft pick to leave early, it's crazy because you're probably not ready, and they had nothing invested in you.
Yeah.
And because they have nothing invested in you, no one has anything invested in you except you, whereas you could stay at your university and they have something invested in your development. And like for a guy like Olivier, he probably could be a second round draft pick, but he's got 2 years of university eligibility left where the people are going to be invested in his future, as opposed to going and saying, well, I got drafted, but I wasn't ready, so I didn't make the team, and now no one has anything invested in me.
So, Dave, we're talking about the kids you don't get, and you can't, and where it's a tough conversation, even if it might be the best thing for them. So who's the kid that you do get? Because it's obviously worked out brilliantly for your program.
Well, we get the Phil Scrubs and the Tommy Scrubs of the world. Like a Phil Scrub who got offered at Washington State, but, you know, his parents are just... They're just so strong in terms of looking big picture and such a strong influence on him. You know, and I'm not saying that Phil wouldn't have made the decision on his own because he's a pretty smart kid, but he's still an 18-year-old kid.
Right.
I mean, he had parents who were looking, you know, long-term, not just basketball, but you know, academically and life, and they felt it was a better decision. And you know, when I talked to them about it, and I go, well, you know, I mean, he could have gone to Washington State. I mean, would that have been a better basketball decision for him? And his dad says, no, it wouldn't have been a better basketball decision for him. And his dad's a basketball guy. He played on the UVic national championship teams. But again, the kids we get are the kids who, whether it's their coach or their parents, are very well informed and know the pros and the cons of it. And you know, like Phil just would not have looked at a small Division I school because his parents knew the pitfalls of that and knew the positives of it, of staying CIS. A kid like Aaron Dornikamp, you know, he was ranked as the 52nd or 51st guy coming out of his class in Canada. And
Wow. Now
he's the only guy in that class, I think, who's still playing basketball, professional basketball.
Right.
And he's playing at the highest level in Germany. He started on a national team last year, and nobody else in that 50 who were ahead of him are still playing basketball. And it's the rules help. I mean, the rules hurt the NCAA teams, and they help us because we can't have team practices, but we can work with our kids. And if we're willing to be crazy like myself and my coaches are and spend hours in the gym just worrying about a kid's development, it's a huge advantage for him. And Aaron took advantage of that. And, you know, for me, I do the national team and I love working with Jay. I think it's an unbelievable experience, and Jay is an unbelievable person to work with, but it's still hard to be away from my guys. I mean, it's really hard to be. I mean, if I didn't have the assistant coaches that I had, I wouldn't do it. As much as it's an incredible experience and working with Jay is incredible and working with the guys you get to, there is no way if I didn't have what I have set up with my assistants, I would do that, just because that's what we offer these kids, is an opportunity to train with coaches all the time.
Two-part question, and it's hard for me to phrase this the way I want to. How often have you sat down maybe with an adult beverage with your feet up on your desk or something and fantasized, contemplated your school being an NCAA school, playing against Division I competition?
I'm not going to say it doesn't cross my mind, but it's just there's so many political factors that wouldn't allow it. And then if we were actually in the NCAA, we'd have to play by their ridiculous development rules. And I'll say it, it's ridiculous. Their coaches are, this includes watching film with a kid, watching him in a scrimmage, working with him. From April until September, they're only allowed to be with them for 2 hours a week.
Yeah.
When they're not in school.
Yeah.
Like, it's not even taken away from their academics. They're not in school, and they're not allowed 2 hours a week. I tell the story to people all the time. I took a couple of my guys down, well, Aaron, who's my nephew, and another one of my players down to a Celtic game, and one of my close friends coaches at Northeastern, and a good friend was at Boston College, and I said, like, can we set up a scrimmage for the guys when they get down there so that they don't miss a run? And they said, sure. So we went to Northeastern, and I'm in the room talking to the coaches, and my guys are warming up, and Boston College guys there, Northeastern guys, they're just scrimmaging. And I look at the clock, and I go, oh, they're starting. Let's go watch. And they go, we can't. Hey, what do you mean, you can't? We can't go watch them.
They're not allowed in there.
They're not allowed in the gym.
Wow.
And I go, well, it's two of my guys, six of your guys, and six of the Boston College guys. Obviously, it's not a practice. And we're not allowed in the gym. And if our compliance officer saw us in the gym, it would be a problem. I go, well, you guys enjoy your time in here for 2 hours because I'm going to watch my guys.
Holy cow. Wow. I had no idea. So here's part two. Let me get to part two because we're running a little late on time. In the fantasy department, has there ever been a conversation about, or have you ever contemplated the possibility of the CIS schools being a conference in the NCAA? Is that in any way more likely? And what does, and I guess the real part of that is there any appeal for that? Does that do anything for college basketball in this country?
I think it would do a lot for college basketball. But again, it's still the problem with it. I mean, there's positives in that it would increase even more the visibility that you know the Raptors have and CIA Bounce have, and it would just increase the visibility even more by having us part of Division I basketball.
Right.
The problem lies in it. We'd probably be one of those mid to low Division I groups, and then the rules of development would hurt those kids who
gotcha.
You know who go to CIS schools and then become European pros who if they went to mid to low Division I schools have no chance of becoming European pros.
Yeah. You know, same kids, different kind of route and they're perceived to be perceived differently.
And they can't develop. I mean, they just can't develop because of the rules. I mean, an example of that is Osvaldo Shani. He was in the highest league in Germany playing with a guy who started 4 years at North Carolina when they were a top 10 team. And he was making double what that guy was making.
Wow.
And he was playing double the minutes that guy was playing. Yet when they both came into the league initially, that guy probably, I don't know for sure, but definitely was playing more and was making more. And I said, well, what happened to one of the coaches in that German league? And they said, your guy was ready. The kid from North Carolina wasn't ready. He got a better contract
initially.
Originally.
Right.
But once you're there, it's no different than the business world. If you go to Harvard, you're going to get a better job than if you go to Austin Peay. But if you do a horrible job with a Harvard degree, you're still getting fired. And if you do an incredible job with an Austin Peay degree, not trying to downplay there because
gotcha.
I don't know anything about it, but if you do an incredible job once you're in the workforce, you're moving up. If you're ready, it doesn't matter where you're from. You just might not get that initial. And that's the whole thing. If you go to small mid-Division I schools, you're not getting that contract in Germany any more than you are from Carleton because they don't – if you're not North Carolina, they don't care about you. They know divisions in Division I. So you're looked at the same way my guys are looked at, and you're less ready.
The name of the school on the degree matters, I've often said, once, maybe twice, and after that, it doesn't matter at all.
you either are good or you're not good.
That's it. Coach, fascinating stuff. It's good of you to take time for us tonight. We greatly appreciate it. Enjoyed the conversation very much.
I really, really appreciate you guys having me on.
Thanks, Dave.
Thanks, Dave.
Dave Smart, the head coach of the Carlton Ravens men's basketball program. It's the elite program in this country. And, well, not only is he a fascinating guy who clearly knows his business, hell, I learned something I didn't know. I had no idea that, and I knew there were limitations on the NCAA, but I didn't realize there were no limitations in terms of the CIU.
In terms of the individual coach.
Individual coaching.
Yeah. Yes.
That's fascinating stuff. Wonder how many kids realize that. And again, even if they did, you know, the lure of the bright lights.
It's pretty strong.
Pretty strong. 20 before the hour. Primetime continues on the Sportsnet radio and television networks.
Prices like no other. From a club like no other. The Fan Club. Log on to Sportsnet590.ca. Now, more of Bob McCowan and Primetime Sports on Sportsnet 590. The Fan.
All right, we have perilously little time because you wouldn't shut up, and
you just got all you got wrapped up in that last interview.
I blame you.
I'm glad you got excited about it. It's good.
So go ahead.
I was going to ask about the Blue Jays. We haven't talked baseball at all, you know. Oh. And I've been here since the I've been around the Jays a lot, but I haven't been here since the season started. I thought last week was, you know, it was not the results were mediocre, but I saw some little stuff that I liked.
I did too.
So to talk about a little bit about what you saw. What you've seen in week one as we head into this titanic 3-game set against the Astros.
Well, you've seen good performances and bad performances from a couple of from the starting pitchers that have pitched twice.
Mm-hmm.
Dickey's had a good one and a bad one.
Yes.
Hutch has had a good one and a bad one.
Mm-hmm.
We had a good one,
Well, Burley had one for the ages,
well,
right?
Well, Burley had a good one. We get to see his second one tonight. Hopefully the pattern doesn't continue.
Mm-hmm.
He has another one. Morrow wasn't on. I've seen enough of Morrow to know it wasn't a good performance for him. I mean, it wasn't horrible, but it wasn't good. McGowan, I think he gave him 3 or 4 starts. I would prefer 4 starts and see where you're at.
Yeah.
First one was bad. Whether he was tipping pitches, his fastball looked a little flat to me. Didn't look like it had life. Guys have those days.
Sure.
You know.
It's also the first game he started in, you know, dog's age. So
home opener, and he was probably a little nervous,
and I thought Hutchinson was a little nervous in Toronto when he pitched. But
so all in all, pitching staff, okay.
Does it concern you they're not scoring runs?
Yes, like, it does. Know? And I mean, you know, two guys that need to perform at a competent level. They don't have to carry the team. But the third baseman and the center fielder have to hit.
Mm-hmm.
They can't hit under 100.
Yeah, no. Well, you know, and there's other guys. Like a lot of guys, I assume Eddie Encarnacion is going to get going.
So
I assume those kind of things are happening. But
I don't think Batista's going to hit 220.
No, but watching Brett Laurie pound the ball into the ground so far, I'm more concerned with that. I actually think Rasmus will snap out of it too because he has had a propensity to be streaky. But Laurie hitting the ball into the ground, which is all he's done. You know, he hasn't hit a line drive this year.
Well, I'm a little concerned that Seitzer hasn't been able to convince him to quiet things down. He's just so tense at the plate. He's so, like, you need to put him on Valium.
Yeah, I think he's less jumpy than he was at the plate.
Well, he is,
yeah.
But he's still too jumpy. That bat is still shaking around in there. And I'm sorry, he's swinging down on the ball, and that's what's going to happen. Now, I don't want him with uppercut swings, but I just like him to be a little bit more quiet. Stay back, be quiet, hands back, hit the ball to right field for a while till you get the feel of it. Then you can try and yank one.
But, you know, maybe my imagination, but Seitzer, there's been some tougher at-bats this year.
Oh, no. I mean, all in all, I think he's done a very good job. I'm by the way, in closing, I'm not as convinced as you are that Rasmus...
Oh, I know that.
...is what he
anybody listens to the show knows that.
See you tomorrow.